From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. And, of course, along with your calls, some topics to talk about, sir.
Right. Going to art museums may actually lengthen your life. Shocking, isn't it? You didn't realize that when you went to the Louvre that your life was actually getting longer. Incredible.
That's funny. I don't think it's working for me.
And we're going to talk about talcum powder for women, use in the genital area, whether or not indeed the data shows that it has a risk of ovarian cancer or not. It's been in the news, but we've got some new data that's really going to shed some light on this.
And our recipe.
Winter pasta salad. When it's winter, it's time for pasta.
Okay, to the phones we go now at 1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Welcoming our first caller, Zorba, a listener with us now in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi.
Oh, hi.
Yeah, how can we help?
My question is, I was wondering how healthy it is or unhealthy it is to eat smoked salmon. I like salmon. I don't really feel like cooking it, and smoked salmon lasts a long time, and it's very easy to get, and because there's no preparation. And I was just wondering how healthy or unhealthy it is because of the sodium content.
I think smoked salmon is great. I eat it all the time. I love smoked salmon.
I could eat it like four times a week if I wanted?
You could eat four times a day if you want.
Right. Okay.
Four times a day. But there really is nothing wrong with it. You know, we worry about smoked meats that are cured because actually they have nitrates and nitrites. So it's really the nitrates and the nitrites that really are the theoretical issue. Once again, it's a theoretical issue. Although we know that in places where they eat a lot of smoked meats, such as Finland, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, that there's more esophageal cancer. On the other hand, we don't know if it's really from that. They also boil their coffee. They have their coffee in a different way, and some theorize it's actually boiling coffee that is leading to this increase in esophageal cancer. But I don't think there's any real data that shows that eating smoked fish has any risk to your health. Now, do you smoke it yourself, or do you buy it smoked?
No, I buy it smoked from the grocery store, from a good quality grocery store in the Milwaukee area.
Oh, yeah. Nothing wrong with that at all. So you don't like to take and cook it. You like to take it. How do you actually serve it? What do you actually do with it?
Well, I just you know, take the back, you know, take the skin off, and then I just eat it just like that. I don't cook it. I just eat it cold.
You just eat it cold. Do you have it with like a bagel and cream cheese? Or?
Usually I have it with a salad.
With a salad. It's perfect. And actually salmon, first of all, salmon is one of the best things you can have. Fish that is fattier has more omega-3 fatty acids. So if we look at some of the fattiest fish that people eat, salmon is number one. Sardines are really good too. A lot of people don't eat sardines. I happen to like sardines. But if my wife walks in the house and I've had a can of sardines, she'll say, oh, you had sardines. So the smell of sardines is interesting, sort of pervades our house when we have it. You're smiling, Tom. Do you like sardines?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. He was smiling because I thought that he actually liked sardines. When was the last time you had sardines?
I don't know.
No, yeah. Do you like sardines? Or Tom?
Oh, gosh, no.
You don't eat sardines either. Oh, my God.
No, I can't get past the smell.
King Oscar sardines, little sardines. I open them up. They're in a little red package. They cost a little bit more. But anyway.
It sounds delicious.
Let's get away from sardines and on to salmon. Salmon, any way you cook it is good. Smoked salmon is good. Enjoy it. It's a healthy meal.
Oh, wonderful.
It's a healthy protein, and it's healthy fat.
Okay. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Sure. Appreciate the call. Smoked salmon without cooking it?
Well, it's smoked, so it is cooked because it's smoked. When you smoke it, you actually cook it.
Yeah, but when you eat it, it's cold.
Yes, it's cold. That's right. Well, have you ever had lox?
I don't think I have.
Well, lox is cold. Lox is salmon that is actually cold. Have you ever had sushi?
Oh, yeah.
Sushi is cold, and it's uncooked. So, but sushi is uncooked. But, yeah, it's cold. I have smoked fish every morning, you know, on Saturday or Sunday. Usually on Sunday in our house, we'd have a little bit of lox and bagel. My mother would buy some smoked white fish, and it was delicious. So cold fish is actually really, really good. Herring, have you ever had a herring?
Yeah.
Herring is cold.
Yeah.
Do you want me to go on with the list?
Well, you can. None of the. I don't like any of this very much. 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. That's 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, before our next call, engaging in the arts lengthens life?
Yes, very, very interesting. These results come out of the UK from the University College in London and really looked at the association between arts. Art activities included going to theaters, concerts, opera, museum, galleries, and exhibits. And it's a longitudinal study of sort of a cross-section of people in England. Now, you might argue the people in England are different than the people in America, which, of course, is true.
Which is true.
Smiling. It's true. But nonetheless, I think even though the Brits are a little bit different, you know, some are posh, some are not posh, we want to look at the data and see what it shows. So it's over a 12-year period. Now, they took into account economics. So you immediately assume if you're going to a museum that economically it's an issue, but the museums in the UK are free. They don't cost anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't cost anything to go to museums. Mm-hmm. And when they looked at concerts, they looked at concerts that were also free. Just like in Madison, we have opera in the park, and it's free.
Mm-hmm.
So they found the people who engaged in arts activity once or twice a year – so I'm not talking about a lot – going to an art museum one time, listening to a concert, had a 14% lower risk of dying of all causes. Okay, I want to go this a little bit further. 14%. People who engaged in arts activities more frequently, every few months or so, had a 31% lower risk of dying.
That doesn't – none of that makes any sense.
Well, it's very interesting. So the question is – I mean, I understand, you know, I understand, like, where does arts fall into it? What is there really a protective association? So the issue really has to do with mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Going to the arts, often there's a thinking aspect. You know, you're thinking when you're going to arts, you're looking at a museum, or you're listening to highbrow sort of music, maybe mental health. And it may be that this mental health actually is an issue. But the real question is, what is there about a cultural activity? Once again, it's an association that may do it. But it may be that it also, because you're doing it with other people, is part of an antidote for depression and loneliness. And when they deep dove into the data, they found the people who didn't go to the arts were often people who are depressed, who are lonely, who are solitary, who didn't engage in activities with other people. So it may not just be the arts issue; it may be the social engagement issue that here that is really
important. People who are socially engaged are more likely to go to museums and that sort of thing. So it isn't that the museum is letting you get
alone. No, it's not. I don't think it's a museum issue. It's like you stand
got
in front
it.
Of
yeah.
a, you know, you may stand in front of a painting and say, "Oh, look at that, that's interesting." Or you're at a concert with others and you're clapping and you're singing or you're saying that's really good. It may be those issues that are there. But this is an important point because when I wrote my book, The Longevity Code, a number of years ago, Your Personal Prescription for a Longer, Sweeter Life, said there's a physical, mental, family and social, spiritual and material spheres, and these all enter into our lives. And since that time, I realized the social sphere is more and more important than we ever realized. And when we are solitary individuals, we are at a higher risk for death.
Yeah, that's very interesting. 800-462-7413 is our number. 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, how can we help?
My question is, I'm not sure if it's narcolepsy or some minor form. In the early mornings when I commute to work, like 30, 40 minutes, it's really hard to keep my eyes open. And I just feel exhausted during the commute. Like when I wake up, it's fine. And at midday, like around 1 to 4, I also get like extremely exhausted again.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not enrolled in classes at the moment, but when I was taking classes, every time I tried to study and open a book, it was like a pixie fairy dumped sleep powder all over me, like I was a coach that won a football and it was Gatorade. And I failed the same three classes three times. I wasn't sure if like is it just me, my motivation,
oh, wow,
or laziness.
Oh, what kind of class?
I got to try harder. And
what kind of classes?
I told my psychiatrist about sleep problems.
Uh-huh.
And I got the blood test and everything's fine. They say I should do a sleep study.
Uh-huh. Now I want to go back for a few seconds. So mm-hmm. What class did you fail? What was the class on?
Calculus 2, organic chemistry 1 and 2, and then the other was physics.
Okay, so those are really tough.
Who wouldn't fluckle?
Yeah, that's right. Tom says who wouldn't fluckle those classes.
Yeah.
But those are very tough classes. What are you studying? I'm going to get a little picture here. What sort of things are you studying to be?
Originally, it was chemical engineering, but now I want to get into neuroscience.
Okay. What's your height? What's your weight?
I weigh right now at the moment around 220.
Uh-huh.
And then height is 5'9", although I've had this problem for years. Like, I haven't been in classes for 3 years.
Okay. But we have a question about sleep apnea. I think that's a very, very valid question. In other words, sleep apnea can produce sleepiness throughout the day. So the first thing you want to do is say, hey, do I have sleep apnea or not? One of the natural treatments for sleep apnea, besides, you know, we have treatments where we put positive pressure in your lungs so that you sleep better. But one of the natural treatments is slimming down and losing weight. For a lot of people, sleep apnea is really a symptom of being overweight. And 220 and 5'9", if you went down, what'd you weigh after high school? What was your weight?
After high school, I actually started slimming down, but I was at about 240 at the end of high school.
Okay, and then you started slimming down. What was your lowest weight when you slimmed down?
My lowest weight was 2 years after that at 170.
Okay, how'd you feel then? How did you feel at 170?
You know, I don't know exactly. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily remember the sleeping while driving problem.
Okay.
Although I did have a different schedule, and the tiredness for studying was still the same, and the periods throughout the day,
especially
around the time 1 to 4, I would just get exhausted.
Oh, sure. Not uncommon. Let's go back a few things. How many hours of sleep do you get at night?
Currently, right now, it's around 5.5 to 6.5, but before, even when the issue was happening, I was getting around 7 to 8.
Okay. Why are you only getting 5.5 to 6.5 hours right now?
Right now?
Yeah. Why so little?
Because I have to pick up my wife. She gets off at 8.
Uh-huh.
And then I have to be at work. I'm at 6 a.m.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And it's about like a 50-minute commute.
Okay. So you've got family issues, family, you know, responsibilities. You've got commuting issues. Okay. How much coffee do you drink? Tell me about your caffeine intake.
I drink no coffee.
No coffee. Okay, so no caffeine.
It's rare.
Uh-huh.
But I've been having this problem with like the small micro sleeping and really hard to keep my eyes open.
Sure.
I do drink a Monster in the morning now, so it helps.
Okay, so you've got some caffeine. What time do you go to sleep at night? What time do you shut your eyes?
I'd say around 9:40 to 10:30.
Okay. And then what time do you get up in the morning for your commute?
About 4:30 or 4:40.
Okay, good. A couple things. Number one, got to find out if you have sleep apnea. Because if you have sleep apnea, it's one and done. That's probably the issue. That could easily be the issue. You can't tell without a screening test to see if you have sleep apnea. Number two, if you have sleep apnea, a positive pressure machine at home covered by insurance, if you have insurance, can make a huge difference. I have people who say, I microsleep, put on my CPAP machine, bang, I'm ready to go. I've never noticed as much of a difference in my life. Number three, a natural way for some people with sleep apnea is actually weight loss because the diaphragm doesn't move as much at night. So for some people who do not have central sleep apnea, they have what I would call biological sleep apnea because they're too heavy and they have too much fat under their diaphragm. Weight loss down just below 200 may make a difference. Number four, you're not sleeping enough throughout the day. 4.5, 5 hours, 5.5, 6 hours. You've got to find another time to nap. Now, I need 7-8 hours of sleep, and I am an expert in car napping. So I often nap in the car when I used to take my kids to soccer. I drop them off at soccer. I'd go into my car. I'd have a nice little blanket in the car, put the blanket on, put a timer on for 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and I would go to sleep. I am a great believer in a nap during the day. And if you're having micro sleeping from 1 to 3 in the afternoon, you're having a monster in the morning with caffeine, you need to have some nap. You may not be able to get it on the job, but you may be able to get it over lunch hour. If you can get that and find a space over your lunch hour, that may be your answer. It may be no food at lunch. You're going to take a short nap, a power nap of 20 or 25 minutes, and you might then be raring to go. If you do it for an hour, you're back in a very deep sleep cycle. But 20 minutes is a different sleep cycle. So looking at ways to micro-nap, looking at ways to sleep more, you are not getting enough sleep now, and finding out whether you have sleep apnea, those are your keys. You can cure this. This is not narcolepsy. This is you need more sleep throughout the day, and you might be a natural napper. Remember, in South America, in Spain, in France, in Italy, they often take a nap during the middle of the day. I am a napper. I believe in it.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Zorba, what's a monster drink?
Oh, it's an energy drink. It's an energy drink. Energy drinks are loaded with vitamins, minerals, and they usually have caffeine. And the name of it is Monster. If you go to a convenience store, which I know you do all the time when you buy your sweet rolls in the morning, that's a joke. But if you go in there, you'll see a bunch of energy drinks. And Monster is an energy drink that's there. I don't drink it, but I mean, I see it all the time.
Yeah. Got it. Before the break now, Zorba, time again to slice our way through the endless catacombs of medical quackery. This is Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Okay, Zorba, here's an interesting question we received from Roberta, who listens to the show on KPBX in Spokane, Washington. She writes, "Hi, Zorba. I love your show, and I listen often. I particularly enjoy when you and Tom talk about quackery, especially the ludicrous health remedies that have been peddled to patients over the years." So, Zorba, I have to ask you this. With all the hindsight we now enjoy, are there any current medicines or medical practices that you think will one day be viewed as quackery?
Absolutely. And it has three letters to it. CBD. CBD oil, there is hardly any, if any, good scientific evidence that it does everything. And it is used for everything. It's used for erectile dysfunction. It's used for cancer. It's used for depression. It's used to make you feel better. It costs a lot of money. It fits totally into the snake oil thing. And I have people say, you know, I put it on my joints and I feel better. And I said, hey, no harm, no foul. You put it on your joints, it feels better. What does it cost? Well, it's costing me about $90 a month. And I go, ka-ching, ka-ching. Ka-ching. We are going to go back 10 years from now, and we may find that there are actually some issues, some uses for CBD oil. But let me tell you, most of it is absolute quack, quack, quack.
Do you have an example of medical quackery to contribute to this segment? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our tasty recipe coming up, along with more of your calls, of course, right here on Zorba Pastor and Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Back to the phone, Zorba, after our recipe for winter pasta salad.
Okay. Do you like pasta?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you like salads?
Yes.
Do you like winter? You like that.
You got me there.
You got that. See? See, you like that. But if you're a skier or a skater and you live in Wisconsin, then you actually like winter.
That's
you
true.
Get to go outside and get to ski and sand. But anyway, winter pasta salad, nice thing, nice salad. Always nice to figure out a different way to serve pasta because I think pasta is great and you get to choose, of course, the pasta that you want to. So let's make the recipe. You're going to use some kosher salt. You know, kosher salt has bigger crystals. You could also use sea salt with a little grinder, but you're going to have some kosher salt in there. A half pound of rotini pasta. You could have regular rotini pasta or whole wheat rotini pasta, or you could have the colorful rotini pasta if you like color, and that's really good if you have children.
Yeah, does it have to be rotini pasta?
Does not have to. But it should be a bulky type pasta. You could use, you don't want to use spaghetti with this. You could use elbows. You could use bow ties. Bow ties would be okay. You could probably use, you know, other types, you know, such a manicotti type of pasta. But I think rotini is
don't say
nice.
You know when I don't know any
I know,
of those
I was just
things.
Thinking, I was just thinking as I'm thinking of you don't know what I'm saying. Anyway, half a pound. Half a cup of extra virgin olive oil.
Half a cup extra virgin olive oil.
A quarter of a cup of red wine vinegar.
Quarter cup red wine vinegar.
You're going to have some regular pepper and a pinch of crushed red peppers.
Regular pepper and a pinch of crushed red peppers.
And, you know, red pepper is really chili peppers, and that's, you know, the stuff that you get in pizza restaurants. And it's very interesting. I read a wonderful book essentially about spices called The Conquest of Taste, and it had to do with spices. And pepper, you know, back in the day was huge amount of money, worth a lot of money back in the Middle Ages. And what's interesting when I read about it is crushed red chili has actually replaced pepper as the hot spice of choice in the United States.
Huh.
And that occurred about 10 years ago. I know that this is something you're really interested
in. Well, I think it is kind of interesting, yeah.
It is. The Taste of Conquest, that was the name of the book. Very, very good book, Taste of Conquest. A teaspoon of dried oregano leaves.
A little tea, dried oregano leaves.
Now, if you are pro-kale, you can do 4 leaves of kale. If you are anti-kale, you can do 4 leaves of whatever you want.
Okay.
But I'm going to leave it that way because I have a T-shirt, you remember, with kale, and do not use kale like no smoking. It's not that I'm against kale, but like kale and everything. It's once they started making kale ice cream and kale toothpaste that I started realizing was going too far. 4 leaves of kale.
4 leaves, kale.
A small head of radicchio.
A small head radicchio.
Yeah, you know what radicchio looks
like?
No,
I don't have a clue.
You don't have a clue. Red. Looks red.
Okay.
Kind of, it's a, kind of a cabbage. I think it is a cabbage. It's in the cabbage family. It has a little bitterness to it, which is really quite good.
You use these recipes to show my ignorance, don't you?
I use those recipes to display your confidence of learning new things, not to show your ignorance, to display your confidence. A 14-ounce can of artichoke hearts drained and quartered.
14-ounce can artichoke hearts drained and quartered.
That's right. You know, I think for this recipe, I got you after the word salt. I think at that point your mind started doing. 14-ounce can of green pitted olives drained and sliced.
Half a 14-ounce can green pitted olives drained and sliced.
You know, I've always wondered, why do they do 14 ounces instead of 16 ounces? You know? Quarter of a red onion peeled and diced.
Quarter red onion peeled and diced.
And you're going to use an ounce of Parmesan or Parmesan-type cheese. Parmesan-type cheese.
Yeah, okay.
Number one, bring a pot of salted water to boil. Easy, Tom. Easy.
I can do that.
You can do that. Add the rotini and cook according to the package instructions, leaving it slightly al dente. I'm sure I'm getting this wrong. It's probably al dente, but it's dente, not Dante. That much I know. Al dente. Drain it and rinse it with cold water. Set it aside. You're cool. You could do this, right?
I can drain, yeah.
Drain pasta. Now, whisk together. You're going to do this with the ingredients. Olive oil, red vine vinegar, and a bunch of rounds of black pepper in there, the crushed red pepper, the oregano, a few pinches of salt. Give the dressing a taste. Add some more salt if you need it. Add the kale, if you're pro-kale. I think kale is okay in this, actually. I think this is an okay kale. Mix it around, massaging the kale with that in order to make it slightly softer. Because kale, as you know, Tom, is a hard green. You know that.
Okay.
You know that. Kale.
I know it now.
You know it now.
Yeah.
Next, add the radicchio, the artichoke hearts, the olives, the red onion, and then a little Parmesan on the side. Toss it, put the Parmesan in it, and on the side, adjust the salt to serve. And it actually is a really, really good salad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the wintertime it's good to serve different salads because we think of salads more in spring and summer. And this is a great salad using what's around, which is kale. Because kale is around all year because it can survive forever. Kale probably survived in the Egyptian mummies, if we look back in the mummies, because the Egyptians, I think, ate kale.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the few listeners who weren't able to write all that down while you were talking, how can they get this?
Well, they can go to the magic thing called the web, the World Wide Web. They can go to the World Wide Web. Go to
I've heard of that.
ZorbaPastor.org and the World Wide Web, and you can pull that recipe, or of course you can find it through Facebook.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. 1-800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Hancock, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba and Tom. How are you guys doing?
Good. How can we help?
Yeah, I have some unexplained puffiness and swelling in my face that's been going on for about 10 weeks, transitioning through a number of symptoms.
Huh.
It all began, I would say, about 10 weeks ago with a puffy lower eyelid on my left side.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I started reviewing my cell phone and figured out that I had that puffy eye, you know, just looking at shots of me with my, you know, children and whatnot, and figured out that that puffiness had, you know, extended probably to, say, like, maybe 12 weeks.
Uh-huh.
So about 5 weeks ago, I noticed a sensation in my lower lip, and that eventually transitioned into a swollen lip a couple of weeks later.
Uh-huh.
And that's about the time that I went to the doctor because I was concerned.
Sure. Makes sense.
And they treated that with a six-day dose of steroids, which absolutely reduced the swelling in my lower lip.
Okay.
However, the symptoms returned once I sort of tapered out of the steroid.
Okay.
And the lip swelling continues, and I recently got another shot, this time a shot as opposed to just taking some pills of some steroids, and it brought the swelling down, and it's been about 3 days, and I already noticed that the lip is starting to swell up again.
So they gave you the steroids because they thought it was an allergy? Why'd they give the steroids?
Yeah, and, you know, they're advising me to consult with an allergist, which is a good idea, although, you know, I have normal allergies, you know, like hay fever in the summertime.
Sure.
And then I have a shellfish allergy, which is, you know, easily avoided, and I just stay away from that stuff and really haven't had any concerns over, you know, a decade.
Yeah. Have you had shortness of breath?
No. No shortness of breath, no fatigue.
Well, do you have any any mosquito bite type things, welts, wheals, you know, anything else on the skin?
Nothing dramatic. You know, I'm not allergic to bees or anything.
And you're not itching all over right now?
No, not at all.
Okay. So you had a course of steroids. How long after this course of steroids, that six-day course, did they give you the injection?
I would say about 2.5 weeks.
2.5 weeks. Okay. So first of all, I don't think it's clear as to what you're allergic to, if you indeed are allergic. In other words, there are hives that you can get, and you don't have hives itself, but you've got something similar with swelling. And when we have hives, sometimes they're idiopathic, meaning that we don't have the foggiest idea why they occur. And they seem to occur often with a white blood cell called eosinophils. It seemed to mediate this somehow. The body turns it on and it says, hey, we've got an allergy type reaction, when in fact there's no allergy around. You know, what's going on and why is this actually occurring? So number one, consulting with an allergist, good idea, because you want to find out if there's something that's in your environment that's actually causing this. It doesn't sound like it, and it may not be that way, because it can just happen literally after a viral infection, something very mediocre, just on its own. You can have this. And it tends to come and go. And for some people, it can last for a while. What's a while? Well, I've had patients where it lasts for 3 to 6 months, even up to 9 months. And we don't have an answer for it. But it goes away. For most people, it goes away. And then the question is, what do we treat it with? Well, the steroids, of course, are the heavy-duty things. But other things you can treat it with is are taking antihistamines, over-the-counter, non-sedating antihistamines in the morning. Zyrtec is probably the best because it's really the strongest of the three non-sedating antihistamines on the market. And I would double the dose. I would take two tablets. I'd probably take 10 to 20 milligrams of Zyrtec in the morning if I tolerated it. At bedtime, I would take Benadryl, 25 to 50 milligrams. They usually come in 25 milligrams at bedtime for sure. I would take Benadryl because, once again, it's an anti-allergy. And I would take we used to give Zantac, but Zantac has been recalled. So I would take Pepcid, which is famotidine. I would take 40 milligrams of that at bedtime. It's an H1 blocker or an H2 blocker versus an H1 blocker. But it can also block histamine response. And I would do that. I'd block all of the allergic response with the non-sedating antihistamine, the Benadryl at bedtime, and famotidine 40 milligrams at bedtime and see what that does. And if that works, with or without the steroid, I kind of stay on it for a few months and see what it does. I still would go see an allergist to see if something is going on. But we've got to hit it with the antihistamines in every way, shape, and form as much as we can.
Okay. Do you think there's possibly, like, neurological issues here with the sensation that maybe I didn't mention earlier is primarily on the left side of the face?
Probably not. I think this is a just like idiopathic hives. I think it's a relative of that. I think it's more allergy, but you may not have had an allergy that kicked this in, and the body just has this goofy response, and we just have to get the body to say, "Hey, I'm fine. There's no allergen here. Stop doing this."
You know, and maybe this is something you've discussed with other callers in the past, but I've noticed over time, and this correlates to what we're discussing here in terms of the timeline. I went through a series of colds, you know, as, you know, I would say about 10 weeks ago, you know, and at the end of every cold, I would say in the past 5 to 10 years of my life, I get this dramatic hive situation. And it usually signals to kind of that it's the break of the cold or the break of the fever. And then I'm usually much better after the hives make an appearance. And then they always go away. I don't know if the two are related.
That is not common. That is not common. That is uncommon. And you've just given the clue. That's the clue. The fact that you have hives at the end of the cold means that you're having a hyperallergic response to that. And that's lingering on. So you just made the diagnosis yourself. So send me a bill. Please send me a bill in the mail. We'll see whether or not my insurance covers it. I don't know if you're in the group that's covered. I don't know if you're in network or out of network, but please send me your bill.
Okay. Well, I think I've got enough to go on here.
You do. You have a hyperallergic response. Hit the antihistamines. Good luck.
Okay,
let us know what happens, please.
Sounds good, Dr. Zorba. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Yeah. You take care.
Thanks a lot for the call at 800-462-7413. Now, before the break, Zorba, let's check in again with your favorite backseat drivers, the Grammar Police. Okay, Zorba, listener Chris sent us the following email. Hello, Dr. Zorba and Tom. The other day, I was innocently sitting at my computer, drinking a coffee, and enjoying a broadcast of your show. At a certain point, Dr. Zorba cautioned against ruining the joy, you know, the vitality we have in life. As a fully commissioned member of the Grammar Defense Command, this caused me to almost have a seizure and resulted in me spitting my brew all over my monitor and keyboard. Dr. Zorba, what is vitality? Is this some strange combination of viral vitality or perhaps viral conviviality? Did you dream it up during one of your famous naked swims?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I was trying – there's a French word, which is the joy of life. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to get that out of my brain. I still don't have it in my brain. Somebody will certainly send it in the email. And I was trying to get out of my brain, so that's what I did. I coin terms all the time, and some of them catch on. you know, like cheddar. I coined the term cheddar back in the day, and now we have cheddar cheese. Mm-hmm. And nobody else even thought of the word cheddar. Of course, that's a lie. But anyway, it was a term that I coined. Who knows what it means, but it's supposed to mean joy of life.
Mm-hmm. Do you have naked swims?
That's another story, Tom.
We have something in common then. Do you want to join the ever-growing grammar police? Feel free to post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org and, of course, through Facebook. And do not post those naked swims on Facebook, please.
More of your calls coming up, another interesting topic to talk about, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. You're on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413, our number. Our next call coming up after Zorba, the association of powder use in the genital area with the risk of ovarian cancer.
That's right. This is a big issue. It's a big issue because, and it's been in the press, because the question is whether or not the powder, talcum powder, is causing ovarian cancer. Now, when you mine talcum powder, talc, it turns out that it's actually near asbestos, whatever it is, in the ground. And so the feds actually many, many years ago said talc should be free of asbestos once we found that, asbestos was bad. Mm-hmm. But there have been a number of jury awards questioning whether or not ovarian cancer is caused by talc that was produced, among other things, from Johnson & Johnson. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe lawyers should decide science and juries shouldn't decide science. Science should decide science. Let's look at this study because it may throw some light. It doesn't give us the answer. Mm-hmm. It doesn't answer the question fully, but it gives some good information. So in this particular study, they pooled data from four large studies, roughly a quarter of a million women, from the Nurses' Health Study, the Sisters' Study, the Women's Health Initiative, and so on. So a quarter of a million women looking over a 20-year period. And they looked at women who were frequent users of powder, using about 10%, used it all the time, women who were partial users, and then women who were never users at all. So they didn't use it at all. And they found that the ovarian cancer among users of the powder was 61 cases per 100,000, okay? Mm-hmm. 61 women per 100,000, compared to 55 cases per 100,000 among the never users, okay? So that would imply there's an increase of 6 cases per 100,000 women. But that's not the only question. The question is, when you do the statistics and you do it, is this statistically significant or not? So on the surface, you would say, looks like it causes more. But when you actually put the numbers through the calculator in the machine and you take all the other variables, there was no statistical difference between users of the powder, common users of talc powder, and never users of talc powder. In other words, it didn't really show any difference at all. Now, you can't double blind this. It's very, very hard to do that. There may be a tiny increase in risk. In other words, that may be there that hasn't yet picked up. But according to this study, if the risk is there, it's infinitesimally small. Hmm. Now, what does this mean? Well, for the women who are worried about ovarian cancer and worried that they actually caused it themselves, I think you can say at this point the chances are very, very slim. For the women who are suing because they have ovarian cancer, I think the jury is out on that. And that's exactly where we sit.
800-462-7413 is our number. 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, let's welcome our next caller, a listener in Ponte Vedra, Florida. Hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, how can we help?
Well, I have two possibly related neurological conditions, both late life onset and ramping up as time goes by. The first is sensory neuropathy, so from the knees down, the elbows down, and part of my face. It's that sensation of numbness or almost wearing compression stockings and compression gloves. The second condition, which is going to eventually become much more debilitating, is spinocerebellar ataxia, which, as you probably know and I didn't, is an expensive way of saying the part of your brain that controls balance and motor coordination is starting to shut down. And in my case, we're pretty sure that that is hereditary because separately, my only sister, who is 6 years older than I am, has been diagnosed with the same thing. And I've been to Cornell Medical Center. I've been to the Mayo Clinic. And they've said, yep, this is what you have. There's no fix for it. Be careful. Exercise. Use a walker. And don't drink. And I stress that last point because I'm not following that advice. What I've discovered after a glass of wine, and I stress glass, not bottle, I am much more stable. So I'm keep doing
on,
what works.
So keep on drinking. I think glass wine is fine. You know, first of all, let's look at what we doctors know. You went to great centers. Cornell, great institution. Mayo, great institution. I'm going to make an assumption you went to great doctors there because they're great institutions. They said, looks like you've got it, smells like you have it, sounds like you have it, your sister has it. And so we immediately say, what can we do? If I get drunk and I walk down the street and I'm wobbly and I don't get it. You know, I got drunk once in the last 3 decades. And it's when I went to Mardi Gras and I had cerebellar ataxia. I had to put my hand on my friend because I thought I was going to fall. So I thought, oh, my God, I've got cerebellar ataxia. Even though I'm drunk, I can't do anything about it. So I know that sensation, and I know the sensation from before that. We know that alcohol in large doses does that. The question is whether or not a little bit of alcohol is going to cause you more harm. Well, you know what they're going to say? They're going to say, don't have anything to drink because if you have something to drink, you may be a little tipsy and you may fall down. Well, you found that having a drink makes you feel better and makes you more comfortable. So you can then go back to them, not that you're going to do that, and say, where's the science that shows this hereditary condition is worsened by alcohol? And the answer is, there probably is no science. You're just giving you general advice. That's what I would think. Now, I'm not an expert on it. Don't quote me. If somebody is an expert on, you know, on spinal cerebellar ataxia, maybe I'm wrong. But my guess is if there's science, it's kind of soft. And if you find a glass of wine makes you feel better and do it, do it. You know, a lot of times when you go to a place like Cornell, they're a bunch of East Coast puritanical snobs. And so when it comes to booze or alcohol, they'll say, don't imbibe. It's bad for you. And it's really because they're Puritans.
That's funny.
But it may be true.
Right.
It may be true. Oh, yeah, don't drink. Bad for you. Don't drink. Can I have a glass of wine? Well, I'm really not sure you can have a glass of wine. Where's the data? If there's no data, then it's anecdotal. Anecdotal information is not very strong. I'll give you examples of bad anecdotal information that we gave for years. My grandfather had diverticulitis, okay? He had it. And his doctor said, you can never eat tomatoes because the seed may be stuck in that little pocket. And that, by the way, was advice we gave for 75 years until a study was actually done that showed absolutely not true. You can have nuts and seeds and popcorn if you have diverticulitis. Where did it come from? Probably some surgeon who took out a diverticulitis pocket and said, there's a seed in there. That's what caused it. In fact, it was bad advice. We get bad advice all the time. Why? Anecdotal information. Now, for the most part, our advice is pretty good, but sometimes it's bad. Have your drink. So do you like red wine or white wine?
Either one.
Either one. Have your drink. Enjoy it. And when they talk about walkers, there are a lot of different walkers, so make sure you have one that's good for you.
Thanks so much for that call at 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, the boss isn't looking, so let's check the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Facebook page. It's time to fire up the segment we call Facebook Feedback.
Facebook Feedback.
Okay, Zorba, first up, James in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin asks, I donate blood, but my beautiful vein is scarring and becoming painful. I'm 68 and not giving up donating blood. Is there something I can do to soften the scar and reduce pain?
Well, first of all, going to the other arm is probably the best thing you can do. And it's basically, it's scar tissue coming from the fact that they're going in there all the time. Sometimes vitamin E capsules will work. Poke a little hole in the vitamin E capsule and massage that in 2 to 3 times a day. That can make a difference. Mm.
And now here's some information about copper from a listener named Joe in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. So we're going to call him the Copper instead of the Copper Police.
Oh, Joe, I love it. Copper.
Joe writes, on the show, someone's physician had a copper level test done on her, and Zorba didn't seem to know why he would do that. The dementia folks don't like high copper.
That's right.
And docs will look at the zinc to copper ratio and recommend you not take additional copper, which is included in many vitamin and eye supplements.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if they look at the zinc to copper ratio, but there is copper poisoning, and copper poisoning can produce a problem. So I'm not familiar with the ratio and what we do, and we do not ordinarily check for copper. I don't remember the last time I actually did a copper level on anyone with dementia. But copper poisoning, a real thing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for all the Facebook comments. And if you have a healthy living question for the good doc, just post on our Facebook page, or you can always send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones we go now, Zorba, at 1-800-462-7413. We welcome a listener now in River Hills, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Zorba and Tom. I'm 63 and for over 40 years have had toenail fungus, onychomycosis, I guess, primarily in the form of white lines or thickening of the nail on both of my big toes. Mm-hmm. My questions are, is there anything I can do to cure it without taking oral medication? I know you've mentioned the lab, so I've been on Sporinox 2 or 3 times. I mean, this has gone on for, you know, 40 years. So I've done a lot of different things. I'm just wondering, because I have a liver enzyme issue.
Got it. So you can't take... you cannot take Lamisil. Like you said, you've been on Sporinox. By the way, were you ever on Lamisil?
Just, I believe, the cream type.
Yeah, the cream doesn't do anything at all. I want to go back. What sort of liver issues do you have?
Yes, I have liver enzymes that raise and down, go up and down because of fatty liver disease.
So if you can't tolerate an oral medication, and by the way, Lamisil can be given 1 week on, 3 weeks off, for 3 cycles. So you don't actually have it in your body that much, and it works 80% of the time, 1 week on, 3 weeks off, and you do that 3 times. But there is actually a prescription. I can't remember the name of it. I think it's called Penlac, but don't quote me. I don't remember the name. There is a prescription nail polish that you can do that's as effective as Lamisil. And it's by prescription, and it may be covered by your health provider, especially if you have elevated liver enzymes. And that's what I would do. Have you ever done that?
I don't know if it was prescription.
It's only by prescription. If you didn't get a prescription, if you didn't pay a copay or full charge, you never did it. That's the only thing that works, and that works as well as Lamisil. And it may work as well as Sporinox for you. So 2 things I recommend. Number one, get your nails tapered down with a Dremel, you know, and podiatrists do this, and I have a lot of people actually do it at home. They actually, maybe it's a Dremel. I always pronounce it wrong, but it's one of the little things that go, pare down your nail, call your doctor, get the solution. As I said, it's a varnish. It's a nail polish that you put on that's antifungal. By prescription, it works. It was proven in double-blind placebo-controlled trials. Over-the-counter stuff doesn't do much. Now, only 80% chance of cure, but I would try it. It's not 100%. Nothing is 100%. However, 80% chance of cure. If it fails, that 20% that weren't cured, if they do a second run, 80% of them are cured. So 10% are never cured. So I would do 2 runs of the nail polish, a Dremel, or as you said, get the nail down to a thin weight. That's your answer. And Vicks Vapor Rub doesn't work. People use it all the time. Smells good. Doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah. Take care now.
We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Before we head out today, Zorba, we love it when our listeners offer up helpful information or interesting ideas. A listener named Dave sent us the following email. A caution about baby carrots. Marketing people are very crafty when you are looking for baby carrots, which we all agree are wonderful. Be careful. The marketers have found that if they can sell big, tough, cheap carrots for more money, if they peel them, cut them into short pieces, and label them as baby cut carrots, look at the packages and you can see the difference. Baby cut carrots are convenient, but they are not baby carrots.
Well, actually, I buy a lot of carrots in the store. Mm-hmm. And some of the carrots are really small and tiny. Those are the ones I like to chew and snack on. And I kind of think of those as baby carrots. I don't know if I really even – I don't even look at the name of the package. I just look at the package. Sometimes I get the bigger ones because I'm using them in soups, and sometimes I get the smaller ones that are a little more expensive because I'm using them to snack on. But, you know, you're right. I'm shocked. Advertising sometimes can be misleading. Mm. Shocking. I thought advertising was great. Think about the supplements. Increase your brain health. Live longer. Think about CBD oil. Cures everything in the world. The only thing CBD oil has not been cured are politics.
Yeah, but is there any difference in the taste between baby cut carrots and baby carrots?
Well, there's a difference in the crunch between a bigger carrot and a smaller carrot. So there's a difference in the crunch and the way you crunch. I mean, some of the carrots are bigger and some of them are smaller. You know, we ought to do a crunch test. That's what we should do. We ought to get carrots. Okay. We'll bring it in here. We'll do a YouTube. Carl has set it up. We're going to do a crunch test on baby carrots. Good idea?
Sounds good, Doc.
See, baby carrots, baby, you and I are going to do it, and we are going to answer this question, and we're going to read the labels, which I have not done. I will bring in the carrots. You and I will do the crunch.
Have a helpful tip for radio's favorite What's Up, Doc? Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org. Let's change the name of the show to What's Up, Doc. I think that's a better idea.
That's pretty good. See you next week, Zorba.
What's up, Tom? Stay well.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web.
At ZorbaPastor.org or, of course, through Facebook or What's Up, Doc?
And you can call us anytime, you know, at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more information on Dr. Zorba Pastor and to listen to current or past episodes, go to ZorbaPastor.org. There you can subscribe to the weekly podcast, and you will find the show archive, Zorba's favorite recipes, his healthy living articles, and other helpful tips heard on the show. That's ZorbaPastor.org.